how to judge the holiday shopping season. Check the numbers, yes, but also check what people bought. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Adrienne Hill in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Tuesday, December 26th. Thanks so much for joining us. With Christmas and Hanukkah now in the rearview, retailers are tallying up just how well or how poorly the season went. And if you listen closely, you can probably hear their collective sighs of relief. Numbers are just starting to come in, but it looks like holiday shoppers were feeling pretty spendy. According to MasterCard Spending Plus, holiday sales were up nearly 5% this year over last. To get a little insight into our holiday buying, we called up Ellen Davis. She's the Senior Vice President of Research at the National Retail Federation. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
So how does this holiday season look for retailers?
We are still waiting for final numbers and won't really know until the middle of January, but it looks so far as if the holiday season was really tremendous for the retail industry. November sales, which is half of the picture, were up 6%, which means we certainly started off with a bang, and everything in December looked good as well. We had great weather. We had a really nice mix of promotions and deals to get customers into stores and on websites. And it seemed like the consumer was out and ready to spend.
Why? Why was the consumer ready to spend?
All year, the economy has been strong. The unemployment rate is low. Wages are growing. The housing market is steady. The stock market is certainly going gangbusters. Many people feel like they're in a good financial situation. What was interesting the first half of this year is that we knew the customer had the capacity to spend, but they weren't really showing dramatic interest in shopping. This holiday season, though, it seemed like either retailers figured out how to entice the customer or consumers were just realizing that they were in a good place financially and that it was time to go out and spend on some discretionary items.
And so what did retailers do to try to entice them?
What's interesting is that most retailers tried to look for ways to kind of pull all of the triggers on their stores and their websites to try and entice people to shop, whether that was buy online, pick up in store, whether that was check availability in a store online. The other thing that was interesting about this holiday season is that, you know, from our perspective, I've been at NRF for over 15 years and seen a lot of holiday seasons, including, you know, the one in 2008 when the bottom really fell out. Even though people will still celebrate the holidays, when times are tight, they'll shop in different places. We saw a lot of shopping in thrift stores, for example, during the recession. We saw a lot of people saying that they were going to buy their kids blue jeans and school supplies, whereas, you know, now you might buy blue jeans because your kids run out and you save a big toy for the holiday gift. So it's interesting to see how, you know, when, from our perspective, what people are buying during the holiday season gives us another frame of reference on where the consumer's mind actually is.
And so what did this holiday season look like as far as that mix of what people were buying?
This holiday season, you hear stores like Neiman Marcus saying that business is actually doing really well. Look, you can buy slippers at Walmart or Neiman Marcus. If you're buying slippers at Neiman Marcus, that might be an interesting sign of the mind of the consumer. You saw a lot of high-end appliances that seemed to be doing very well, regardless of if they had a promotion. Certainly some more expensive toys were on the radar for a lot of families this year. And that points to us as if families were feeling a little bit better about their financial situation, had saved up to buy holiday gifts, and were going to make it a pretty special day for people.
And going with the things nobody needs but people want, the fun of the holidays.
Sure. I mean, so during the recession, we saw a lot of denim purchases. We saw cold winter apparel that would be a necessity, warm boots, warm gloves. We saw a lot of sales of crock pots. You still see some of that, but you see, you know, the $100 Instapot. You don't see the $9.99 crock pot that you just turn on and off.
Right.
There are real differences in how people choose to shop based on how they're feeling financially. Some of that is conscious, but quite frankly, some of that just might be completely in their subconscious, but, you know, part of the element when they go shopping.
Ellen Davis is Senior Vice President of Research at the National Retail Federation. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The markets today were not sighing those same sighs of relief. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Next-generation batteries hold a lot of promise for things like phones, laptops, even the cars we drive. But the power grid? Today, a proof-of-concept case for you. Tesla delivered, in a matter of months, the largest battery in the world to Australia. And when coal-fired energy went down recently, the battery energy filled the gap and kept the lights on. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
This Tesla tale began with a bet. Company founder Elon Musk tweeted that he'd deliver a giant battery power plant to Australia in 100 days, or else he'd do the project for free. Tesla, which has missed deadlines for making electric cars and batteries, came through this time. Ethan Zindler is with Bloomberg New Energy Finance.
In the grand scheme of Tesla bets, this wasn't the biggest. This one seemed actually eminently doable, given that they have a massive battery manufacturing facility.
Then the Tesla plant got tested. This month, two coal-fired power plants went down under. But no blackouts, the batteries filled the hole. Instantly, says Michael Weber at the University of Texas Energy Institute.
Batteries can do that really quickly. They can respond in tens to hundreds of milliseconds, which is a fraction of a second. And that's much faster than a typical power plant.
That matters, because a moment of unstable power can wreak havoc on, say, a big data center. Weber says batteries aren't just reliable, they're getting cheaper since they're now being made at scale.
Just in the last years, batteries have moved from sort of small niche applications, say for a phone or a laptop, and from small mom-and-pop operations to these really large conglomerate companies like Panasonic and others are doing large-scale manufacturing.
He says batteries aren't perfect. They're heavier than alternatives, and eventually they lose their charge. You have a phone, right? Well, Jigar Shah, founder of the energy finance firm Generate Capital, says even used batteries are good for standbys in electricity emergencies.
Those batteries still have a lot of life left in them. They just can't give you that full 200-mile range that you're used to on your car. But they can still be used for the grid.
Many analysts think battery power plants will be cheap enough in a few years to displace some fossil fuel plants, at least the emergency backup ones. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
The U.S. used to produce more uranium than any country in the world. Most of it was mined in Wyoming. Since the 1980s, prices have slumped. Production has fallen off. But now some U.S. companies are betting that's going to change. Uranium is key for the nuclear energy industry, and hundreds of new nuclear reactors are being planned in China and India. Inside Energy's Madeline Beck reports.
William Goranson is driving out to look at a uranium mine in northeast Wyoming.
I feel like this is my third time I've gone through business cycle where we're always on scraping by with our nails to stay alive.
Wyoming's economy largely depends on coal, oil, and gas, but uranium mines could start helping out. And Goranson, with the Energy Fuels Company, is one of the people planning for uranium to come back. We went to Energy Fuels' uranium mine in northeast Wyoming, called Nichols Ranch. Like most uranium mines now, it uses in-situ mining. That means that instead of a big open pit, the uranium is mined using pumps on a hillside. The system sends a solution underground to dissolve uranium, then pumps it back up, and uranium is separated out. Goranson says the company expects uranium prices to rise in the next few years, and is ready to ramp up production.
Won't be a double, but we'll be building capacity into double production.
Energy Fuels isn't alone. At least four other companies are also buying up or shaping up Wyoming properties to start producing the ultra-heavy element when the time is right. And it is heavy. When pure, this silvery white metal weighs 10 pounds per cup. Scott Melby is with the uranium mining company Uranium Energy Corp. It's one of the companies getting ready for the potential boom. The company purchased a mine in northeast Wyoming. And Melby's got
1 foot on the brake and 1 foot on the gas.
Melby spoke this summer at the Global Uranium Symposium in Casper, Wyoming. On stage, he told industry leaders they just need to hunker down.
If we can position ourselves to be ready to respond when prices turn, I think it'll be very good news for everyone in this room.
Uranium prices are still depressed from an earthquake 6 years ago, the one that hit Japan and caused a tsunami and a meltdown at the Fukushima nuclear plant. Every time there's an accident like that, nuclear energy goes out of favor. Plants shut down, there's a uranium glut, prices drop. But China and India combined are building 26 reactors and plan to build nearly 250 more in the coming years. And that's going to take a lot of uranium. Still, the Natural Resources Defense Council contends that the uranium market might not rebound that much, especially with slow nuclear growth outside Asia. Jeffrey Fettes is a senior attorney at the NRDC.
We think in Western democracies and in Western Europe and in the United States, we don't really see any future for the nuclear industry for quite some time, if at all.
Even if uranium mining doesn't grow, Fettes says it needs more oversight to protect limited Western aquifers, which are impacted by the mining. He wants more groundwater testing before mining starts, in neighboring aquifers, and after mining is done. The Environmental Protection Agency tried to increase those protections in 2015, but failed. At the end of the Obama administration, the agency put out a similar version that's still on the table.
It's slightly weakened from the first iteration, but it's still a dramatic improvement.
And now there are calls from Republicans to abandon the Obama-era proposal. Goranson from Energy Fuels says he doesn't believe the proposed rule would improve environmental safety or public health beyond what's already required. That currently includes groundwater sampling around the facility and some neighboring sites. He says U.S. rules are already some of the strictest in the world. In Laramie, I'm Madeline Beck for Marketplace.
That story comes to us from Inside Energy, a public media collaboration focused on America's energy issues. Coming up?
Probably between 50 and 60,000. People love coffee cake. Who would have thought?
Really, who doesn't love coffee cake? But first, let's do the numbers. On a quiet trading day, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was off 7 points, down just a tiny bit to finish at 24,746. The Nasdaq lost 23 points, 0.3%, to close at 6,936. And the S&P 500 shed 2 points, 0.1%, to end at 2,680. All those positive retail sales numbers we mentioned, all those expensive slippers we bought, lifted department stores. Macy's climbed 4.5%, JCPenney rolled up 5.4%. Kohl's climbed 5.9%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.47%. You're listening to Marketplace.
When it comes to news about the economy, Marketplace has got you covered. And when you donate $10 a month or more to support the work we do, you can get a Marketplace umbrella to help protect you from stormy weather. The real benefit of giving comes when you listen every day, knowing that you're making it possible for Marketplace to help people understand the economy and the financial forces that govern our lives. It's important work that we're already doing, and with your help, we'll be able to do more of it and reach more people as well. Become a Marketplace investor today at Marketplace.org, and thanks.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Adrienne Hill in for Kai Rizdahl. The last few weeks on the show, we've been talking about colors, the business and economic backstories of specific shades. Today, we have a look at what happened when a very particular color was touted as a way to solve some big social problems. Here's Cassia St. Clair, author of The Secret Lives of Color, with more.
In the 1970s, people were getting very worried about rising crime levels. And in fact, people were referring to crime waves. But in 1979, a psychologist called Alexander G. Schoss announced that he'd discovered the secret to making people less aggressive. And the secret, according to his studies, was a very particular shade of pink. In fact, the pink that we now know as Baker Miller pink, or even drunk tank pink. So Baker Miller pink is really a very unattractive shade of pink. To my mind, at least, I think it's rather a sickly shade of mid-pink. Baker Miller pink became a kind of pop cultural phenomenon. The psychiatrist who had initially worked on the studies and tests would go on TV shows and radio shows and talk about the power of this pink to sap strength and to minimize aggression in the people who were exposed to it. It was also used by bus companies in their waiting rooms and on their seats, in the drunk tanks of small town prisons to calm people who were left there overnight. And then finally, it was used in the visitors' locker room of an American football stadium. However, the whole phenomenon of Baker Miller pink has since suffered a bit of a decline, kind of an academic backlash that challenged all the initial findings, although its latest outing has actually been in the bedroom of Kendall Jenner, who had read somewhere that it suppressed appetite. I have to say, I've never seen any scientific study of anything to do with appetite. She has, but used it in one of the rooms in her house.
That was Cassia St. Clair with an excerpt from her book, The Secret Lives of Color. And if you can't picture Baker Miller pink, it's worth looking up. I think sickly shade of mid-pink is a fair description. We've got it on our website, marketplace.org. We're now in the semi-relaxed no-man's land between Christmas and New Year's, when you can still enjoy your baked goods and sweets without too much guilt. That all ends next week, I'm afraid. This is also the time of year when retailers, those retailers we mentioned at the top of the show coming off crazy busy holidays, have earned themselves a little downtime. That's true for Amy Emberling and Frank Carollo. They're the co-owners of Zingerman's Bakehouse in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Non-Michiganders may have heard of their mail-order delivery service. Think sour cream coffee cakes, brownies, ginger snaps. Amy and Frank recently published a cookbook with some of their most popular recipes. The book is also called Zingerman's Bakehouse. Amy and Frank, thanks for being here.
Our pleasure. Hello.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
I wonder if you can start with just describing Zingerman's Bakehouse for people who aren't familiar with it.
Well, let's see. We are located in an industrial park on the south side of Ann Arbor, and we have really about five different components to the bakehouse. We have a bread bakery, a pastry kitchen, a cake studio. We have a little retail shop, and we have a baking school, and we have about 24,000 square feet and 150 people who work 24 hours a day, pretty much 7 days a week, making delicious baked goods.
Do you have a sense of how many sort of sour cream coffee cakes you guys are making every year?
Yes, probably, probably between 50 and 60,000.
Wow.
Yeah, people love coffee cake. Who would have thought?
So Zingerman's is a company I'm familiar with through mail order, since I've not lived in Michigan, but I have gotten some excellently timed Zingerman's care packages. What is the relationship of the bakehouse to the rest of the Zingerman's empire?
We're sort of like a loose confederation of businesses, a little bit like how our government works with states. So we all use the Zingerman's name. However, we're owned independently. There's a little bit of joint ownership. The founders of the original business, Zingerman's Delicatessen, own some of each of the other businesses. But all of the other owners do not own parts of the other businesses. And we work cooperatively together in determining some big picture things like how we do benefits or service. But in terms of running our businesses, we're entirely independent. So it's a kind of interesting mix and often brings a productive tension.
Frank, you've been at Zingerman since 1992, and I wonder how the business has changed in that time.
Well, when we started, I didn't know what opportunities we would have, nor did I know how much people would embrace. I mean, from the start, humbly I'll say, hearth-baked European-style bread didn't exist in Michigan in 1992, and people just really loved it. And so we grew at a rate beyond my sort of wildest dreams. And now it's an 800-square-foot store that does a ridiculous amount of business in an industrial park.
Amy, tell me a little bit about your holiday season. When does it start for you guys?
Well, really, it starts in August when we begin the planning for it. Right. And every year it moves back. We realize we really can't do anything other than consider sort of day-to-day business starting in August. So there's a lot of planning that goes on in August, a lot of coordination with Zingerman's mail order. They're our biggest customer during the whole holiday season. And then it really starts to ramp up middle of October. Right now, we're sort of winding down, but it's all through the fall.
And what's your January like? Do you guys get to take a break? Is that when everybody goes on vacation?
It's amazing. I always tell people it's as if there's, one of those red emergency stop buttons in the sky and that somebody just whacks it at about 3 o'clock on December 24th and it's done. And then it's quiet and nothing happens. And so we're really quiet until Valentine's Day, or in Michigan, Fat Tuesday is a very big day. We have a large Polish community and we make a lot of donuts.
Is that Patchkeys? Is that
Punchkeys?
Punchkeys. I was close.
Right. Right. It was close. So it picks up then. But we're grateful to have a little time off to breathe once that happens.
I want to talk to you guys now about your cookbook a little. I know some people will have gotten this book as a holiday present. They're probably flipping through it right now. Are these the actual recipes that you use? If I follow this to the letter, if I measure my ingredients or weigh them, am I going to achieve those same brownies I would get in the mail?
You absolutely will. And you mentioned the key word that to help people, home bakers, the single most important thing to do is invest in a $35 digital scale and weigh all your ingredients rather than measure them by volume. And that is the single biggest step that will get you great results every single time you bake.
Why give up the recipe, though? Are you worried that people won't order next time around when they have a chance to order, when they're really craving those brownies or whatever it is?
Some people may not. And that will just leave us room to continue to develop new things. And I think in reality, there are a lot of people who are not going to bake the things and they will continue to buy from us. Some of the things in the book are really difficult, Adrian, and I think people will realize why they cost what they do when they come to our stores and may decide that it's really worth it and would rather not make it. So in terms of business overall, there's so much more to having a successful business or bakery than just these recipes that, we feel okay about sharing them.
So before I let you go, I want to ask if there are any recommendations you have for folks, in this week before New Year's diets kick in, what should they be cooking? What would you recommend one thing they cook for this week in between Christmas and New Year's?
I think I'd take a little break and make something very tasty but not so difficult that's in the book that's called Detroit-style pizza. A lot of the country doesn't know that we have a style of pizza that's distinctive to Detroit, and it could be a really nice midweek meal.
And anything you might cook, Frank?
Well, I guess there's a recipe for chestnut baguettes, and thinking about a New Year's Eve party, if you make those baguettes with some chestnut flour, they pair wonderfully with a nice piece of cheese. And you'll be a winner if you make those for New Year's Eve party.
Well, happy New Year's to you both. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Adrian.
Thank you.
Amy Imberling and Frank Carollo are co-owners of Zingerman's Bakery and authors of the new cookbook, Zingerman's Bakehouse. We've got the recipe for that Detroit-style pizza. It's at marketplace.org. Check it out. This final note before we go today, for the past dozen years, the Library of Congress has collected an archive of every tweet tweeted on Twitter. Now it says it's stepping back. Turns out the archive doesn't need quite that much sharing, snarking, reacting, joking Twitter. Instead, the Library of Congress will only collect tweets it deems significant, including, and I quote here, themes of ongoing national interest, e.g. public policy, which does, I guess, speak to the world we live in, where public policy gets made on social media. Today, the Dow was off 7 points, down just a touch. The Nasdaq lost 23 points, 0.3%, and the S&P 500 shed 2 points, 0.1%. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. Ben Hethcote is our digital visual producer. Sarah Muti is our executive director of digital, and Sitara Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. I'm Adrienne Hill. We'll see you here tomorrow. This is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.